Ralph Moody. In fact, there was a firm, K. Robinson and Moody. There was a man named John Calderwood. He and I were admitted the same day as one of the first judicial acts of Judge McCary.
Is he still around?
No, he left many years ago. We both were admitted on reciprocity. He was from Colorado, and I was admitted on reciprocity from the District of Columbia.
How long was he here?
I'd say no more than 6 or 7 years. He was mostly, had a commercial practice. I'm sure I'm forgetting some very important people, and if we look at the signatures on the Gridley picture, they would come back to me. There was a guy named Evander Smith, practicing then, and his firm was Smith and Oz, and that's Dorothy Oz Holland. Yeah, Evander left before I did in 57. He left to go to San Francisco. Oh, maybe he went first to Texas and then to San Francisco. They had a little office there on next to the old City Hall on East Street between 4th and 5th.
Was Dorothy Tyner here?
Dorothy Tyner, at that time, I think, was in Seward. I was instrumental in having her appointed to the bench as a district judge when I was attorney general. Edmund Lewis was in Juneau at that time. He was a government attorney for one of the government agencies.
Did he have that same outside view?
You can't tell about Eben. Eben is just this thoroughly nice human being, and he never looks down on anybody. But on the other hand, I think he was sort of detached. Yeah, probably is to this day, but in a different way, not in a superior daddy knows best, but he's sort of a gentleman in a rough and tumble world, and he somehow manages to walk through the mud without getting his cuffs dirty. Very few people who can do that. He's also somewhat naive as a result of that. He's sort of a Brahmin type.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, who else was here? Well, let's talk about Fitzgerald. Fitz's greatest failing is that he's never been in private practice, except nominally for a couple of months. He's strictly a government man. He became very popular as a judge because he had some notions of fairness. And he was a reasonably good lawyer, nothing outstanding. And the rest of the bench was so horrendous by comparison that he just looked like a giant. And that early reputation has followed him and been like a charm in his career.
Are you talking about the original Supreme Court?
The original Superior Court. Yeah, no, he didn't go on the Supreme Court again, except much later.
Uh-huh.
And he was totally out of place there. Fitz is not a legal scholar, and he doesn't belong on an appellate court, and he was bored to tears and frustrated. He's a good workaday trial judge. Of course, he, like every other federal judge, is gradually getting federal judge-itis, which is unfortunate. Federal judge-itis is an affliction that flows directly from a combination of great power and life tenure, which is one of the grave mistakes in the United States Constitution. I am an advocate of the Boyko Amendment to the American and Alaska Constitutions, which reads as follows. No person shall hold any office of power over life, liberty, or property for more than a total of 10 years. Because I think at that point they start getting a God complex and get totally insensitized to ordinary mortals' feelings, failings, weaknesses, mistakes, aspirations.
What about Vonderheide and Plummer?
All of them. Ray Plummer was one of my best friends for many, many years, and he was one of the finest judges we had when he first went on the federal bench. In fact, during the reign of terror of Buell Nesbitt, I had a policy. I would not take, let's say, a personal injury case unless the plaintiff was prepared to establish diversity of citizenship, if necessary, by moving to Seattle so I could get into federal court and get Plummer. But Plummer got judgeitis, as inevitably anybody would. I probably would if I got on the federal bench. It comes with the turf, and it is reinforced by the federal judicial conferences, where the old Turks take the young, starry-eyed appointees, if they are that. Most of them aren't, because that's how they become federal judges in the first place. But assuming they're still idealistic and democratic and easygoing, they get brainwashed. By the time they've been to their third or fourth judicial conference, they come back and, you know, they're paranoid about the whole world. Mm-hmm. And they treat everybody with contempt.
Did people like Fitzgerald, who didn't go into private practice, did he have an outsider's view, like these federal?
Oh, I'm sure, yeah. I'm sure Jim did, and maybe still, well, I'm sure it does now, because that goes with the federal turf. Sort of switch allegiance when you become part of the federal judiciary.
Did that whole, can you tie what you're talking about as the outside view, or what I've labeled also the outside view, something that also happened at statehood, the changeover when Nesbitt took the court and tried to make it so separate, mm-hmm. was that a view that was put on the system itself later? That all judges were going to be separate?
Well, again, that goes with the turf. There is a certain amount of distance the judges feel they have to put between themselves and their former colleagues at the bar. And I can see why that would be. In fact, the ones that don't make me feel uneasy at times. You know, the ones that retain their old cronies. And there are such. But Nesbitt cannot be generalized. Nesbitt was a man with a serious problem, and he went totally overboard. I mean, the power completely went to his head.
Let's not get to Nesbitt yet, because that'll take a while.
Yeah.
Some of these people that you've mentioned, were there cliques of people that went around together?
Well, inevitably there are, of course. You know, people. Well, it was more old-timers versus newcomers. I remember very vividly. I attended a Anchorage Bar Association meeting, and after the meeting, Harold Butcher, who later on became a dear friend of mine and still is, sort of wrinkled his nose and said, "Where did you come from, you know, or from what rock did you crawl out, from up under what rock did you crawl out?" I mean, that's not what he said, but that was the clear inference I got. I mean, there were maybe 30, 40 lawyers here and maybe 60 on the outside, and people like myself and Cliff Groh and Dave Talbot were upstarts, you know. But it didn't take him very long to accept us as equals. And, and then there was the usual division between the plaintiff's bar and the defense bar. There were two major defense firms in those days. One was Davis, Renfrew, and Hughes, and the other one was Plummer and Arnell and Plummer. And Arnell and Plummer were the offshoot of J. Gerald Williams's firm. And then, of course, Delaney's firm is the offshoot of Plummer, and Burr, Pease, and Kurtz is the offshoot of Arnell. See, Arnell and Arnett got together for a while, and they didn't get along too well. And then Don Burr went in with Arnell and inherited his practice. And Arnell died rather unexpectedly.
Why didn't Arnell and Arnett get together and get along?
They were just too different. Ross Arnett is you know, easygoing, laid-back, comfortable, old shoe-type guy, you know, and Arnell was kind of a driven, hard-working, charging workaholic. And Ross, I'm sure, wanted to work 9 to 5, and Ed just couldn't see that.
Is Don Burr the same type of person as Ed Arnell?
Yes and no. He's not nearly as thorough. And he is smart enough now that he's reached a level of success to delegate and allow himself to enjoy life. And I'm saying that as a compliment. Ed Arnell never would have. I mean, he would have. He did die with his boots on. But Don, I think, has learned that that's not the way to go.
What's Ed Arnell's background?
I know nothing about Ed Arnell except that he was here a long time before I got here. And was, you know, considered one of the leading lights. He mostly represented insurance companies and construction firms.
Davis, Renfrew, and Hughes. What were they like?
Well, they were your typical insurance defense firm. And Dave Thorsness, who was for a while McCary's law clerk, then went to work for John Manders, eventually went with them and became a senior partner in the normal evolution of seniority.
Did Manders ever have any relationship with Davis and Renfrew and Hughes?
No.
Just with
Thorsness? No. No. Manders had a firm called Manders, Butcher, Dunn, and Connolly, which didn't last very long. Other than that, he was always a loner. I mean, he had, you know, associates like Thorsness from time to time. I don't know if... I was thinking maybe Russ Arnett worked for him once, but I'm not sure of that. Yeah, maybe not. John Manners was mostly a loner. I mentioned John Rader, I'm sure. Well, he was working for McCutcheon and Nesbitt when I met him. And Kay Robinson and Moody had, well, Ralph Moody was the city attorney. And he wanted to quit that, but the K firm wanted to retain the city contract, so they had a guy named, oh, I can't think of his name. Poor guy, he was an alcoholic. He had an Irish name. He was an associate, and they wanted him to be named city attorney so they could keep the account. Well, Vern Martin and I had just recently started our partnership, and the city attorney's job was up for grabs on a contract basis. Mm-hmm. And we put in a bid. And George Shannon, who was the city manager, didn't care much for me, but he liked Vern Martin, and he wanted him. But Maynard Taylor was the mayor, and it was his appointment. And Maynard was a friend of Wendell's, and Connors was the guy's name, Gerald Connors. Wendell was pushing. Nice kid, but with a drinking problem. Maynard Taylor jumped through the hoops for Wendell and appointed Connors, stating that there were no qualified Alaskan applicants. Well, that didn't sit too well with Vern and I, and I put out my first press release, many over the years, and made banner headlines accusing the mayor of lying. And there was a big rhubarb, and of course that killed our chances of getting it, but it also put the kibosh on Gerald Connors. And I ran into John Rader, whom I had met and liked, on the street. And he was sort of thinking of maybe leaving the firm. And I said, John, why don't you put your name in? You'd be a good one.
What firm was he with then?
McCutcheon and Nesbitt.
Well, McCutcheon and Nesbitt, yeah.
And he said, you know, that sounds like a good idea, and he did. And of course, that was the start of his political career. Now, our political paths crossed again in 68. When I resigned as Attorney General, I thought that I didn't want to get out of politics altogether, so I filed for the state Senate in the primary. In the same primary, Rader filed for Congress on an anti-war platform and anti-Vietnam War, and lost. I won the primary, but decided after my taste of politics that I really didn't want it because a lot of reasons that I won't go into, but I just wanted out. And so the Democratic Central Committee was to nominate my successor, but I made it a condition of resigning that I have a veto power over the appointment. And they had came up with some names I didn't like. And then I finally, John Rader was looking for a slot because he had lost the primary for Congress. Mm-hmm. And we finally agreed on him. And he took my place, was elected, and then went on to become president of the Senate after a long distinguished career. So I gave him two starts, sort of, once as city attorney and once as state senator. He probably doesn't remember either, but I do.
You are quite well known for your battles in the press, but that is one of the...
Go ahead. I have often said that I can make headlines or keep my client's name totally out of the papers, depending which will serve his purpose. I don't seek headlines for headlines' sake. I consider publicity or the court of public opinion one of the many weapons in the arsenal of a trial lawyer, which, if used with effectiveness, can be a very important factor in getting the results for your client. Decisive is an overstatement, certainly important. It's very, very difficult to win a legal battle in a hostile public opinion climate, even though I was able to do that in the Browder case, Jim Duncan, my client. But go ahead.
Go ahead and tell me about the Browder case after you finish explaining.
Well, by and large, I think it's very important to create a favorable public opinion towards your client, whether it be in a trial or in a battle like between the city and Chugach. And you cannot create that unless you have at least part of the media with you. And I've always worked on that principle. And it's a symbiosis, sort of. I like to think that I'm not using the media and they're not using me. We work together. They need news and I need, from time to time, the publicity or the editorial support. And I have an ongoing, long-standing personal relationship with the working press. And, you know, they get material which they need from me and I get what I need from them. And I don't... There were some reporters, only one I can really think of, namely Gloria Fisher, who used to work for that's Victor Fisher's ex-wife, who used to work for the Times, who felt that I was using her, you know. And Yeah. It seems to me if you're giving a good story to a reporter, to say to use him is like saying you use a doctor if you bring an interesting medical case to him. You know. What are they for? Well, where are they going to get their stories unless somebody gives them to them? But, you know, Gloria and I never saw eye to eye, although I think more highly of her than I do of her husband, ex-husband.
What about the bride?
All right. I was practicing law in California, and I had a client named Jim Duncan who had met me up here in Alaska when he was the manager of the first Anchorage TV station, which was KTVA, Midnight Sun Broadcasting Company, Bramstedt's outfit, which is now KTUU. And he had left Alaska and gone into oil and gas drilling ventures. And I was his attorney in Los Angeles. And he had left Midnight Sun Broadcasting Company to go with Browder when Browder was on this meteoric rise, rubbing elbows with the powerful and being the fair-haired whiz kid. I never had trusted him. I advised all my clients to stay away from his investments because I didn't like the smell of them. Jim Duncan went to work for Browder. He became a vice president and a president of one of the subsidiary companies and a fair-haired guy. He was a first-class salesman type promoter. When the House of Cards collapsed, he left. He was broke. I mean, he lost everything he had. And by the time he got back on his feet, he got very successful in the oil drilling business. And I was his client, his attorney, and word got out that indictments were going to come down against the Browder Group. And at Jim Duncan's request, I came up here and found out that there had been established a strike force for the state, headed by a former fraud prosecutor who had helped indict and convict Billy Saul Estes for his swindles in Texas, and a joint force with the federal government, including people from the IRS and from the securities agencies, and these people were working full-time on the Browder indictments. And as soon as I found that out, I made arrangements for Jim Duncan to come up here and be arraigned and immediately ask for a speedy trial. And the idea was, you see, Browder and his brother had skipped to Texas. And I knew they would be fighting extradition. By bringing Jim Duncan up here and immediately demanding a trial, and knowing as I did that he was as much victim as co-conspirator, probably more so, that I'd have a chance of beating the case. If he were in the same dock, so to speak, with Browder, Tom Browder particularly, there wasn't a prayer that could save him, because he'd be tarred with that broad brush. And when people, you know, heard that the people were in a lynch mood, I hired Hank Taylor, who is now a lawyer and was then the best investigator in the state of Alaska, to investigate a lot of things, including every member of the jury panel. And I had a little file card box, with an investigative history on every member of the jury panel. And in those days, the jury panel lasted like 6 months. And Hank told me, and another guy, that PR guy I talked to at the time, told me that people were ready to lynch anybody connected with Browder. The atmosphere was horrendous. And so I had to get a severance of Duncan. Ed Davis was the chief judge, and of course they were trying to get Browder extradited, and he was fighting it very skillfully. And so they didn't want Duncan to go to trial, yet they had no excuse. And in those days, of course, we didn't have the 4 months rule. And so they would make these spurious delay motions, and Ed Davis would routinely grant them, and I would scream, early trial, speedy trial. Finally, they couldn't get anywhere with Browder. Browder had been ordered extradited from Texas and skipped into Louisiana. He committed himself for a period to a mental institution and was kicked out of there. And so they had the idea of using Warren Culver, who by this time had become the U.S. attorney. Let's see, he was U.S. attorney first and then attorney general. So he was U.S. attorney then. And Warren Culver, you met Warren Culver, I'm sure.
No, I haven't.
He's a client of mine right now. I have a case for him. Warren Culver cooperated with the state by getting some kind of a phony tax indictment against Tom Browder, because it's much easier to get a defendant from one federal district to another than to go through the extradition process. So at this point, Browder was desperate, and he started running out of money. And I know what the game was. They wanted to delay Duncan's trial until Browder could come up here, right? So I don't remember whether I called Browder or Browder called me, but I think Browder called me because I sent word through Duncan that I was willing to help him further fight the extradition to help my client, because he was running out of funds and running out of escape hatches. And at this point, he had jumped into Mississippi. And the governor of Mississippi was Ross Barnett, the famous Ross Barnett, who stood in the door of Old Miss to keep Medgar Evers out, entering the school? A racist of the worst kind. And he had a law firm in Jackson, Mississippi, and he had a partner by the name of Green. And I retained that firm to represent Browder. And I talked to Green on the telephone, and he was very disinterested. I mean, you know, yeah. And I told him, you know, that Warren Culver, the U.S. attorney, had come in and was trying to drag, to do the dirty work for the state by dragging Mr. Browder up. And he asked sort of casually, he says, well, what kind of a guy is Warren Culver anyway? And on the spur of the moment, I said, well, pretty nice for a Negro. And man, the atmosphere changed. All of a sudden, they were gung-ho to keep that fine white Texan from being dragged up to Alaska by this Negro U.S. attorney, right? Anyway, here we go again. They kept him down there. And the state is stymied, and I'm going up for, again, asking for speedy trial. A new trial date is coming up, and the state is coming again before Davis, asking for another delay. And at this point, I've dropped a big bomb. I filed a multi-pages affidavit of disqualification for cause against Ed Davis, setting forth all the delays that he had granted, the in-camera conferences between him and the prosecutor without me, all the things that I had found out. Ed Davis screamed, ranted, raved, said it was outrageous. Well, of course, this all hit the papers. I don't know how they found out, but they did. Ed Davis went into, he had a very short fuse, and he went into a rage and said it was outrageous on my part, and of course, he had a right, he had wore two hats as the trial judge and as the presiding judge. And when he met with the prosecutors alone, it was in his administrative capacity and blah, 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 and he couldn't be disqualified, and he wouldn't disqualify himself. And after he ran and then raved, he assigned the case to Fitzgerald. Fitzgerald called the prosecutor and me in to court. And the trial had been set for the following week, but Davis had once again vacated it. And Fitzgerald said to the special prosecutor, he said, is there any reason why you can't go to trial next Monday? Oh, yes, we've got witnesses coming from all over the country and we've released them. How long will it take you to bring them back? 3 weeks? So, okay, he set it for the 22nd day after that. It was again a Monday. On Friday before the Monday, they called me in and he said, there were 115 counts against my client, against all of them. And they said, well, if your client will give us a statement, we'll dismiss all the counts. Because we had offered to give, he had offered to give them statements from day one. That was just a face-saving maneuver. They knew I'd beat their ass and it would hurt their later case. So he gave a statement and they dismissed all 115 counts. Eventually they got Browder and they tried all the other defendants. They all were convicted. Browder died in prison. So Duncan was the only one who got away. And I think properly so. I think, as I say, it was more victim than anything else. He got snake charmed by Browder just like the way everybody else did. But so did some of the other defendants. But with Browder in the same council table, they didn't have a prayer. Interview, and we're now on the subject of the old-timers that I was familiar with in territorial days. We've talked about George Grigsby, of course. I mentioned John Hellenthal. He was Ralph Cottis's partner. John Hellenthal and I didn't see eye to eye very much. We had a confrontation in 1954 when John Hellenthal, well, first of all, I should say I was a delegate then to the State Democratic Convention, which was being held in Juneau. It might have been 53, I'm not sure whether it was 53 or 54, but it was the first year that I was unhatched, as they say. I was no longer in the government. And I'd become active in the Democratic Party, and Steve McCutcheon, Stan's brother, had sponsored me for the delegate's job. And it became very important because there were two candidates for the National Committeeman job. John Hellenthal was one, and the late Ken Johnson was the other. At that time, the Democratic Party could roughly be divided into a liberal majority which supported and was controlled by Ernest Greening, whose lieutenants were the McCutcheon brothers. Greening was living in Washington at the time. And a non-Greening conservative wing consisting of Ken Johnson, Ray Plummer, Harold Butcher, Ed Davis, Stan Wilson, an Anchorage attorney of the firm of Wilson and Wilson. He and his wife practiced together. They took over J.L. McCary's practice when he became a judge.
Was Juliana Wilson involved in politics?
No. neither of the Wilsons was very active, but Stan was semi-active in the Democratic Party and was in that wing that I was described. When I first came in, I had no particular allegiance to either side. I had never met Ernest Greening. Later on we became very strong and fast friends, and I became a great admirer of his. But at the time, I was slightly repelled by some of the authoritarian things that he had done as governor and that were being carried on by his lieutenants in the same tradition. He was sort of a mini Roosevelt. He was a great humanitarian and a brilliant man, but he could also be very ruthless politically when he had the power. And I guess when Steve McCutcheon sort of sponsored me for the delegation job, he assumed that I was automatically going to fall in line whatever he wanted, and he didn't bother to tell me whom he wanted. And I got to know John Helenthal and was not terribly impressed. On the other hand, I was approached by Ken Johnson for my support. And this was very critical because they had a tradition then, which is no longer applicable in the Democratic Party. We had what was called four judicial divisions, which is the same as the judicial districts now. And every 4 years, the National Committee job would be rotated amongst the divisions. Well, this was the third division's turn. And so the 10 delegates from the third division, each division had 10 delegates. It was not a one-man, one-vote situation. Each division had 10 delegates, and among the 10, they were supposed to, of the third district, they were supposed to, division, they were supposed to come up with a candidate. So 1 out of 10 votes was very critical. And some of the other delegates were Wendell Kay and Bill Egan and the McCutcheons and Irene Ryan. And of course McCutcheon. Greening group had picked John Helenthal, you know, who was an old-timer. And the day we got down to Juneau, walking down the street to the convention hall, Irene Ryan and Steve McCutcheon informed me that I was to vote for Helenthal. And I said, tough luck, you know, I've already made a commitment to Ken Johnson. Well, they were flabbergasted and started belatedly to try to change my mind, but I had made a commitment, I was going to keep it. Well, when we got to our caucus, lo and behold, we were split 5-5. So Wendell, always the great compromiser, well, first we were 5-4 because Bill Egan could nowhere be found, and then they ran and got him, and that made it a tie. And Wendell proposed a compromise, and Ken Johnson, we were in a hotel suite at the Baranoff Hotel. Ken Johnson was sent downstairs to the bar along with John Helenthal. And Ray Plummer was Ken Johnson's campaign manager, so to speak, as McCutcheon was Helenthal's. And the compromise was, well, we can't accept Ken Johnson because he's too radical, but he is very conservative. But we'll go for Ray Plummer. And that was the decision. And I, being the new kid on the block, was selected to go down and bring the news and get their consent. Well, Ken Johnson readily accepted. Helenthal was very upset and threatened a floor fight, which he was bound to lose because the conservative element had the votes on the floor. And from that time on, he really didn't like me, even though all I was the bearer of bad tidings, although, of course, I also was one of the swing votes. So much for John Helenthal. We've talked about John Rader. We've talked about Wendell. Can't read that. What does that look like?
John Clennon? I don't know.
John Dunn.
No.
Oh, John Dunn. I bet you're right.
John C. Dunn?
Yeah.
Doesn't look like it, but that's probably who it is. Gerald Connors, he's the guy I told you that the K. Robertson and Moody firm, it was their candidate for city attorney. That's Seaborn Buckler Jr. He, when I first came, he was the U.S. attorney for the 3rd Judicial Division. He quit soon after I went into private practice with Vern Martin, and he came with us just as a tenant. And we gave him overflow business and told him how to practice, showed him how to practice law. He then later joined Wendell Kay's firm and stayed with them until he ran for the legislature, and then he was in the legislature for a long time. And
did he practice while he was in the legislature?
Yeah. I think I should probably revise what I said. I think he stayed with the Kay firm while he was in the legislature. But he didn't spend very much. It wasn't a very active practice.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to think. I think he stayed with them until he became district attorney here in Anchorage, and then a judge. Okay. Ray Plummer, we've discussed. Edgar Paul Boyko, you know who we're talking about. Bill Sanders. Sanders was a partner with Bailey Bell, whom I've mentioned before, and Bill Tallman. At that time, Bill Tallman, I don't think, had been admitted to the bar yet, but he was, I used to run into him in the bar library, courthouse library, studying for the bar, but he soon thereafter joined them.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Sanders, Bailey Bell and Bill Sanders had primarily a plaintiff's personal injury practice, and then Tallman came and continued in that same vein. Bill was kind of a nice, straight guy, not nearly as astute as Bailey Bell, but very gentlemanly and by some not considered too brilliant. And he eventually, of course, became a judge in Nome and is now retired. Yes, ma'am. Sure. Earl Cooper was another very active Democrat. He, at that time, I think, practiced law by himself. He had been district attorney in territorial days. But I forget whether he was an assistant under Plummer or Plummer was an assistant under him. I think. Plummer was first and Cooper second. And then Cooper went into private practice and eventually ran for the legislature and became a member of the territorial Senate and then went on the bench but had a stroke and had to be retired for medical reasons. He was a nice man. I liked him. He was a liberal, a kindly person. He was not Cardozo, but he was well-liked.
Were most of the lawyers involved in politics to some degree?
Many of them, yes.
As much as, are they so today?
Not to that high degree, because it's a much larger bar.
Is it just a matter of numbers?
Yeah, it's a matter of numbers. But I think that there was a tendency in the old bar, in the territorial bar, to be more involved also. In other words, the numbers were smaller, but the percentage was probably higher. We've talked about Bailey Bell, John Manders we've talked about, Kay Ritchie we've talked about, George McLaughlin we've talked about, Evander Smith I've mentioned, John Conley I've mentioned, Stan McCutcheon we've talked about. Now, Buell Nesbitt was Stan McCutcheon's partner. He was known to be a very astute, somewhat ruthless and aggressive lawyer who had an alcohol problem. And at times a severe one. McCutcheon kept bailing him out in the figurative sense. He was quite controversial and not too well liked.
And why was he so controversial?
Well, a number of his clients accused him of sharp practices. He and McCutcheon had been involved in a bank, which eventually led to McCutcheon being indicted by his friend Seaborn Buckaloo, which really hurt him badly.
Was that Union Bank?
Union Bank, yeah. And
what was the indictment over?
Oh, some technical violations of the banking laws. No terrible thing. But it was very bad for McCutcheon's image. See, he had been an all-powerful political viceroy under Greening's gubernatorial situation, and the indictment came after the national administration became Republican, and there was a Republican-appointed governor and territorial governor in Juneau, and Buckaloo, I think, with poor judgment.
Was it political?
Yeah. Buckaloo just did what he was told.
Was Buckaloo Republican?
No. On the contrary, he was a strong Democrat and a good friend of McCutcheon's. But Washington told him to indict him, and he indicted him. I mean, that's the kind of guy Buckaloo is. He follows orders.
Mm-hmm. What about Bill Nesbitt? What kind of sharp practices?
Oh, the one guy, once in my presence, a rather volatile Italian miner, accused him of stealing his mine by some machinations, and he was involved in... I had a client later who accused him of stealing her business, Anchorage Cold Storage, which is now owned by Milt Odom. It was founded by a man named Curl Kastner, who had been sort of an Alaskan war hero. Kastner's cutthroats were making raids against the Japanese when they were ensconced in the western Aleutian Islands, the only American territory ever occupied by the Japanese. And when he retired from the army, he sunk his life savings in this Alaskan cold storage, and he and his wife Rachel ran it. And then he had terminal cancer, was down in San Francisco dying, and there were some minor bills that had accumulated, and Nesbitt used that for Union Bank to seize the place, and I was very ruthless about it. Eventually I represented Rachel Kastner and sued the First National, which had become the successor of Union Bank, and got her settlement and made her happy.
Mm-hmm. Was it common for people to take, this is a little bit aside from that, take fees in non-cash things such as deeds to land or mines?
It still is.
As much as it was?
This I couldn't really say.
Were there certain people known for taking...
Some people were more inclined to do that. John Connolly and Pete Walton come to mind. They always wanted real property,
mm-hmm.
and built quite a real property empire. But I took interest in oil and gas leases and things like that when I practiced, and I still do that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good arrangement for both sides, because cash is a very difficult commodity for a lot of people to come by.
Is it common throughout the country to take fees that way?
Well, I can't speak about the country. It's done in California, where I practiced. It was done in Maryland, where I practiced. It may not be as common in other places, but I think it's more common in smaller towns and rural communities, perhaps, than it is in the big cities.
Was it more common in territorial days, because it was smaller then?
I can't say, because it wasn't much more common with me. Yeah, maybe. Maybe I did more of it, but I think that had something to do with the kind of clientele I had then and I have now. I represent a lot more people who have money that they can pay now than I did when I first started, and I think that's usually the case with the lawyer's development. And maybe that's why I was more inclined in those days to take a piece of a mine or a piece of an oil and gas leasing block or a gold jewelry or nuggets. And we do that still today, more for security than for payment.
Okay. I've mentioned John Connolly.
John Connolly had a commercial real estate type practice mostly. He was well liked. He was a gentleman. He had first been Harold Stringer's partner. Mm-hmm. And when Harold Stringer was more or less ruined by J.L. McCary, whom he had not only made a judge but forced down the throats of the Bar Association, Connolly went with Walton.
Did Connolly have strong political ties?
No. Connolly was more a social type. He was well liked by the... He and his wife, Betty, were well received in the so-called upper strata of the Anchorage Society. Mm-hmm. And Walton was never active in politics. Stringer, of course, was a strong Republican. He was a national committeeman at the time. And the National Committeeman was very important in the Alaskan parties and territorial days because there weren't any elective offices mm-hmm. outside of the territory.
Was it common for lawyers to be National Committeeman? Didn't you just say Ray Plummer was?
Ray Plummer was National Committeeman and Stringer, but I can't think of any other lawyers since then who were National Committeemen, so I would say no.
Did they have a say in the judges?
Yes.
And the commissioners.
Yes, because you see, we didn't have U.S. senators then. Mm-hmm. We only had a non-voting delegate in Congress, who was Bob Bartlett. And of course, in the Republican administration, he had no say. Mm-hmm. So the national committeeman and the governor, the appointed governor, were the only people. And John Heintzelman, who was the appointed governor, knew nothing about judgeships, lawyers. He was a forester. And so I guess Stringer was the man who had the say.
What about Paul Robeson? Did he have any say?
I don't think Paul was very active politically. Paul was always involved in business dealings, real estate. He prided himself of never going into a courtroom if he could avoid it, and never looking at a law book. But he was very astute and very popular. I succeeded him as counsel for Chugach Electric. He'd gone down to, I think, Washington, D.C. I don't know where he went. I think it was Washington, D.C. to get advanced training in public utilities law. But he left Chugach at a time of crisis, and they needed somebody in a hurry. And when he came back, I was ensconced, and he was out. And he had been very active in the Bar Association to block my efforts to get the Bar Association to stop the selection of a non-member of the Alaska Bar as city attorney. When the Moody K. Robertson and Moody firm tried to push that through, and I almost had the bar convinced to pass a resolution, and then Paul Robeson made a very effective pitch and talked them out of it. Let's see, I've mentioned Buell Nesbitt. Buell Nesbitt, to get back to Buell, as I said, Buell was controversial and not too well liked. He then straightened up his act, became a teetotaler, somewhat fanatical.
When?
I would say just about at the time of just a few years before statehood. Mm-hmm. And he became a leader in the fight against McCary. And that gave him a big boost in the popularity with the bar. And of course he was McCutcheon's partner. McCutcheon didn't want to be a judge. So all of a sudden, to everyone's surprise, he was supposed to go on the Judicial Council. after statehood, and then Egan appointed him to the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, which was quite a surprise to everybody. Butcher went on the council instead. Butcher and Nesbitt hated each other.
Why?
Just, they were so totally different.
How?
Butcher was a gentleman. Nesbitt was a street fighter. Butcher was, even though conservative and somewhat straight, was a humane person. Nesbitt was a tyrant. And, of course, he power totally. At first, he did a great job organizing the court system because he was a good organizer. He had been an executive on a Navy ship, and he was a disciplinarian and a driver, and he got things set up quickly and effectively because it suddenly the Ninth Circuit declined further appellate jurisdiction. The state of Alaska had thought they could coast along for several years. And so they had to create overnight a court system. And Bill Nesbitt did a good job getting it going, and then the power went to his head and he became, I think, deranged, which led to the big fight with the Bar Association and to the one and one time only rejection of an Alaskan judge.
Before we get to that, who was Nesbitt up against for the judgeship? Who else was being considered?
I don't know. I wasn't here at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I was in California. I missed all the excitement of statehood. I mean, I'd come back and forth, but I wasn't living here then.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of all happened. With Nesbitt, of course, were appointed John Diamond, who was the son of Anthony Diamond, Tony Diamond, but not a chip off the old block. Tony Diamond was a saintly man with great compassion for humanity and great understanding for human frailty. But, John was almost a recluse and very doctrinaire and kind of a strange person. Didn't have at all the charisma of his father. Walter Hodge had started out as a single practitioner in Cordova. He and I had met and become friendly. He was a little man, kind of nervous, pretty sharp lawyer, good legal grounding in legal theory and knowledge. With a limited horizon, having practiced for years in a tiny little town as the only practitioner. He became a judge in Nome and then moved on to the Supreme Court. And his horizons broadened, and he was always very tender-hearted and sensitive and kindly and just a nice person. He could not get along with Nesbitt, and when the chance came for him to be appointed United States District Judge, he quit the court, setting the precedent which was later on followed by Fitzgerald. I've already mentioned George Folta, I think, who was the other district judge who was there for a long time. We had Diamond. We had Hodge, we had Folta and Juno, and Harry Pratt in Fairbanks. I tried my first case in Alaska before Harry Pratt in 1953,
mm-hmm.
before I was even admitted to the bar. And the reason was I was the counsel for the Interior Department, and we had a trespass case against the Triangle Lodge was sitting on the Alaska Highway right-of-way, and the trespass case had been pending for 6 years, and Bob McNeely was the U.S. attorney. Mm-hmm. And he and the trespasser and his attorney, Warren Taylor, were all cronies up there, and so I insisted on prosecuting the case, and I tried it with McNeely sitting in for the first 5 minutes, and then he said, well, it's evident you know what you're doing, and he left. Against Warren Taylor. It was my first taste of Alaskan justice, because I had, in the morning of the trial, I had offered into evidence the official survey plat that showed the offending building, which had made a lot of money during the war, sitting on the right-of-way, right in the middle of it, without much as by your leave, and because in retrospect that right-of-way was much too wide anyway. Government always overkilled. But that was a gung-ho young government lawyer, and this was wrong, and I was going to do something. Well, I had offered this plat into evidence, and Warren Taylor, this is Judge Warren William Taylor's father, who had come up the hard way and been a fireman on the Copper River Railroad and had read law, and he was another street fighter. He was shrewd and gutsy and not always terribly ethical. But I liked Warren. He was a Runyon-esque character, or a Jack London character, maybe a bit. Anyway, came time for the lunch recess. And Warren still had the plat. And Judge Pratt, who wore green eye shades and sleeve garters like a car dealer, plus his robe, went striding out and then suddenly turned, reached for the plat and said to Warren Taylor, "Give me that." Then he grabbed it and walked off with it. And the clerk of the court was a man named Dixie Lee, who had been there for 40 years. White-haired gentleman who later became a territorial senator after he retired from the clerkship. I said to him, "What was this all about?" "Well," he says, "we've sort of had a rash of key exhibits disappearing during the lunch hour. The judge wasn't taking any chance." Judge Pratt, incidentally, was the father of Octavia Hansen, who figured prominently in the 1978 gubernatorial primary litigation. She was the supervisor of elections here, who had bags of ballots loaded into her nephew's car, and ballots disappeared into closets, and all kinds of strange things happened. But that was his daughter. She didn't stay on after that.
Was there a lot of that sort of thing happening when you were up here? Exhibits disappearing, procedure?
Well, Bailey Bell was accused of purloining one out of Buckle's office in a criminal trial, and Judge Folter had him arrested. He had his office in the central building across the street from the a federal building, and Tom Merton, who later became my client, he was an assistant U.S. Marshal, and then became the man involved in the Arkansas penal system, who was portrayed by Robert Redford and Brubaker. He's now a professor of criminology at the University of Minnesota in Hawaii. But anyway, he was a swashbuckler. He and Dave Talbot were the ones I told you about, would go with guns strapped to their boots and raid the Last Chance Club for after-hour drinking or gambling or whatever. Anyway, he went across the street and put, and Bailey Bell was a man then in his 60s and always wore a Homburg hat. And I don't know if he wore spats, but if he didn't, he should have. And he snapped the handcuffs on him. There was quite a uproar about that. And Judge Diamond bailed out Bailey Bell by making a finding that the law under which he was indicted applied only to courts of the United States, and that this is not a court of the United States, but a territorial court, which I later used. First motion I ever argued in Anchorage was before Judge Diamond, and the last motion calendar he ever had, because he died shortly afterwards. And it seems that Ed Davis's client had issued an attachment against a truck owned by the Bureau of Land Management up in Palmer. We had a temporary employee who wrecked the truck, and his father said that he would pay for it. Put it into a garage in Palmer. They repaired it, and then the old man wouldn't pay for it. And they exercised the lien. And we just went and got it. His Majesty's government, you know. And Ed Davis furiously went into court and brought an action under the Miller Act, which is a government contract sort of thing. And I moved to dismiss, assisted by Dave Talbot, who was an assistant U.S. attorney, on the grounds that it was not a court of the United States and therefore didn't have jurisdiction over an agency of the United States. And Judge Diamond was taken aback and took it under advisement. And then he died without ruling on it. And finally, McCary, who couldn't conceive of not having jurisdiction over anything, ruled the other way, but by that time we had settled the case.
Let me just ask you a question about the type of people who are practicing different kinds of law. You people like Ray Plummer and Ed Arnell.
They were mostly insurance defense.
And Davis and Renfrew are all insurance defense. Can you categorize people by the personalities they have, that they're more likely to practice a certain type of law?
I think both Plummer and Arnell and Davis were conservative types. Bill Renfrew defies characterization. He was a Hemingway-esque character. He was a he-man and a two-fisted drinker and pilot and hunter and mine gold and traveled all over the world and had a rasping voice and was very macho, and he didn't fit into that at all. He and I had a famous brawling case, which I cleaned his clock and shocked the hell out of him. McCutcheon, Bailey Bell, Bill Sanders, Jim Tallman, were typical, you know, plaintiff's lawyers, although McCutcheon was political, while the others were not. McCutcheon was involved in a lot of other things, mining ventures and whatever, natives, Indian law.
What kind of people were
there that they were involved in plaintiff's work? Well, you know, it's I don't know how to characterize them, but they were more underdog fighters, you know, and they're more aggressive, and it's hard to categorize whole classes of people.
Which do you consider yourself?
Well, I started out definitely as a plaintiff's personal injury, and what my friend Leonard Schrader from Seattle, who plays a certain role in Alaska, calls an odd tort specialist, such as defamation, professional malpractice, that sort of thing. That's been my thing. Interference with contract, conspiracy to deprive people of rights, civil rights litigation. And I've moved into a broader spectrum now. I do everything from that. I continue to do that. We have like a sex discrimination class action going right now that's going to trial in November against the municipality of Anchorage, the telephone utility, and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. For this was for systematically discriminating over many, many years against women in the employment. And everything, wages, salaries, promotions, hiring. It's incredible. And I'm doing the defamation suit against the Right to Life people for Dr. Brown and others. On the other hand, I also do a fair amount of non-insurance defense work. I represent Western Airlines in the defense of several lawsuits. I represent Hickel Investment Company, although they are a plaintiff in a case against PNC. I also have, on the other hand, a case against PNC for false arrest and malicious prosecution, an abortive shoplifting incident. I always have done a fair amount of criminal work up here, not so much in California. California practice is more business oriented.
Do you notice the difference in your reputation if your practice is more business-oriented in California versus the criminal and plaintiff work?
You're considered socially more acceptable, but that has never bothered me one way or the other. I've always created my own aura of respect because of the results I got, and people would denounce me as a maverick, a troublemaker, and flamboyant and all this, and the moment they got in trouble, they'd beat a path to my door, so I never worried. I'm fairly secure in my self-image and have been for a good number of years.
What about with the newspapers, with Atwoods? What happened with that?
Well, I think I started out as an admirer of Atwood when I first came here because he was the head of the statehood committee. I was very pro-statehood. He gave a speech once which I thought was very thoughtful, and I even remarked at the time to a mutual friend, Herb Hilscher, who was one of the constitutional delegates later, that I thought that speech had marked Atwood as a major candidate for eventually being a United States Senator from Alaska. And then after I got to know Atwood and his mean and petty streak, I was very instrumental, perhaps the instrumental factor, in blocking his bid for the U.S. Senate by denying him a bipartisan endorsement.
When was it?
That would have been in 56. The Constitutional Convention had taken place and the legislature had voted to have two senators and a congressman elected under the Alaska-Tennessee plan. And Greening and Atwood had, who were then friends before Atwood stabbed Greening in the back, had agreed on a bipartisan ticket, Greening and Atwood. And the Greening forces called a special session of the special state convention of the Democratic Party, and it was a magnificent operation. I mean, Greening lieutenants corralled every delegate, and they not only did they do that, but they always had somebody with them who was in a position to exert some influence. Like I was working with Chugach Electric at the time, so they brought the chief engineer to talk to me with, along with Irene Ryan, solicit my vote for Greening. And Greening had it by acclamation. When we had the meeting here in Anchorage, I was the chairman. I had been at the permanent convention, I had been made the chairman of the Resolutions and Platform Committee. This was the Fairbanks Convention, which had been held earlier that year. And so it just carried over. And Greening was nominated by acclamation, and the doors flew open, and he marched in, and it was just sort of like, you know, that presidential convention. But then his forces, see, they didn't play the thing right. They wanted that resolution passed endorsing Atwood, who was a Republican, on the theory that it would be better for the effectiveness of the Alaska delegation to be bipartisan, which had a certain logical appeal. And of course, Egan was the other candidate. No. Yeah, Egan. Yeah, Bartlett was in the House, and we didn't do anything about that. He was the Tennessee delegate and the Tennessee congressman. And Egan was the other candidate for the Senate, besides Atwood, Democrat. And instead of putting a resolution timely through the committee, I guess they figured that I was anti-Atwood and I wouldn't go for it. It couldn't be controlled. So they tried to get it on the floor. Well, first they came to me in the last minute and wanted me to call my committee together, and I just stood by the convention rules and said no. Put it on the floor. And of course, to get it on the floor, they had to have a suspension of the rules and two-thirds of majority. And two of his lieutenants, Ralph Rivers and Bob Ellis, Ellis Airlines and Southeastern, tried to push it through, and I made a rabble-rousing speech about the Democratic Party being the party of statehood. And why would we, as a Democratic state territorial convention, endorse a Republican? And got a big applause, and they just withdrew the whole thing. And then Egan defeated Atwood. Atwood got very bitter after that. I think that was the big blow to his career. And we also became juxtaposed because I was the front man for Chugach Electric in its fight for survival against the city municipal electric utility. And Atwood spearheaded, he was the patron saint of the city of Anchorage, which was young and brawling and expansive and sort of dog in the manger. And so editorially he fulminated against me. And I beat them regularly and consistently in court and in the legislature and on all the other fronts. And one thing led to another, and the culmination came. Virgil Sizer, who had been a colleague of mine in the Bureau of Land Management, he was the manager of the Anchorage Land Office, had been a sort of Trojan horse candidate for the Chugach Electric Board of Directors. Virgil O. Sizer, S-E-I-S-E-R. And he and another guy named Mackey, I think, were the city's candidates to undermine the management, and they were elected. And Sizer particularly was obnoxious in on the board to the loyalists in trying to obstruct everything that Chugach Electric management was trying to do. And the employees of Chugach Electric got very upset, and they felt that he was doing a lot of politicking on government time and was away from his office. And he and Atwood were constantly closeted and plotting, and George Shannon, the city manager. And so they circulated a petition to the Secretary of the Interior to investigate him for abuse of his government powers and the use of government time and so on. And they came to me as Chugach's counsel for advice, and I said, no, absolutely not. Because there's no way that the hierarchy in the Interior Department will go against Sizer. And all it'll do is backfire. It'll make a hero out of it. Well, sure enough, they went ahead without my consent. And a couple of months passed, and there was a big whitewash. Secretary announced that there was no wrongdoing and that Mr. Sizer had been maligned. Banner headline in the Times, under the byline of a special correspondent, a guy named Robert Smith, in Washington. And directly in the front of the story was, according to a prominent, knowledgeable source in the Department of the Interior, the petition was masterminded by Edgar Paul Boyko, counsel for Chugach Electric, which was an out-and-out liar. It was the opposite of it.